Hello, this is William Fink, and this is the Christogenia Open Forum. It is Monday, December 6th, 2010. The year's just about done, huh? I don't know. I don't have a whole lot to talk about tonight. I really enjoyed doing last night's program. I don't know why, but I did. It was honestly put together at the last minute. But I put the notes and the program on the front page of the MK site. If anybody didn't hear it, I would recommend it. You know, Wesley Swift, Bertrand Comparé, many people on the religious right or the conservative right today, that they say that world globalism is communism. That they make that admittance. We hear it all the time in right-wing news sources, right-wing media sources, from our own mouths. Adolf Hitler knew it, and he knew it 80 years ago, 90 years ago. And you know, the Jews try to push all this propaganda on us that Adolf Hitler was a Jew. That's a lie. Adolf Hitler was a Rothschild agent. That's a lie. Adolf Hitler was only a simple Christian man who had the nerve and genius to put together a movement that stood up for Christianity. It's not his fault that he didn't know that the kingdom was handed over to the beast. It's not his fault that the Jew wanted to rule the world, and he didn't want to agree with that. That's the way it was. We have to defend Christendom, and Adolf Hitler is certainly a part of that tradition. And the shame of it is that most Christians don't even know it. They're deceived by the Jews into thinking that he was an evil madman, and that they'll believe anything because he was an evil madman. And that's just crazy. So if we want to talk about that, we could talk about that. I hope we have something to talk about. And I hope maybe people post that podcast in other places or post links to it, or especially in white nationalist forums, right? Or talk about it and spread it around or something. I think it's last night was probably one of my favorite Mein Kampf series programs that I did with Sword Brethren. And that's all I'll say about that, unless anybody else has any questions. If anybody wants to talk, please do so, because I'm going to be out of stuff to say real fast. And this is an open forum, and I can't do it alone. I mean, we can't have an open forum program without having open forum participants. So I would ask somebody to want to say something, right? Eli James starts his own, he starts this microeffect.com program tomorrow. The microeffect.com, it's not a big site, right? Their rating is like 1.2, 1.3 million on the Alexa ratings. But it's an opportunity, I think, for Eli to reach a crowd of clientele who are seekers, but not identity, right? I mean, a lot of people find that they go looking and they find that they find all kinds of forks in the road, and you have to pick one and you go down it, and sometimes you get to the end and there's no bridge to the other side, right? And that describes most of the forks in the road. And there's a lot of New Age people and Zechariah Sitchin type people and that kind of crowd and conspiracy buffs, and it's it's a place full of rabbit holes, but I think maybe something good will come out of it. We'll see. Aside from that, I hope somebody wants to talk. This is an open forum. Or I'm just going to sit here and play more Lunatic Fringe, right? Hello, Gerald. How you doing?
Hey, Bill. Am I coming in good right now? Or
well, you're breaking up. You're breaking up a little, Gerald.
Well, I don't know what else to do. I've adjusted everything. Can you make out what I'm saying?
Yes, you're all right. How you doing? Praise Yahweh. Okay. How's it going?
Okay. Well, I wanted to. I've mentioned this once before, and it's on a personal note, but I'm getting down to the point where I've got to something. I've been trying to find someone, preferably a CI individual, who needed a place to stay for a long period of time, or even a few months or something, to stay here in the house, to try, you know, to be here to just help me, in the event that I have a problem or something, not to wet nurse me, but just to be here. And, they would be able to live here rent free, maybe help a little bit on groceries and utilities, but that would be the only expense. I'm getting to the point where I'm having more and more problems, and I had a big episode this afternoon, and it's quite upsetting. And I don't know how much longer I can stay here alone and, you know, and continue. I do not want to go into assisted living because I've seen what they do to those older people, and it ain't pretty. They take advantage of them. They prescribe one medical procedure right after the other because they get paid big bucks for all this. And those people can't help themselves, and they literally are tortured to death. They don't live that long, and they keep them doped up. And I'm not going to live. I'm not going to go through that, and I'm not going to let a bunch of niggers hurt me and all like they are doing in these nursing homes. So, I'm reading what Mac Dog says, but I don't have the finances to pay for nurses to come here, and I've already checked into it, and I don't qualify. I draw a little too much, just a little too much Social Security not qualify. And, you know, they don't care if you have mortgages or what kind of expenses you have. They just bottom line and make a decision. Plus, I'm white, and that's a mark against me. They don't go out of their way to help any white people, at least not down here in this area. So one of the reasons why I was going to sell part of the library to try to help, you know, out a little bit, but if anyone knows of someone that might fit into that category, I want a no smoker. I don't want a drunk. You know, they might have a toddy with me if they want to once in a while. But, you know, and I certainly don't want a deviant, you know. And I don't want Adam and Steve, you know. But if you know of anybody knows of anyone, please let me know. And, you know, I would appreciate it very much because I am getting down to the wire where I've got to do something and things are not too pretty. So, that was all I really wanted to say on a personal note. I could talk about, somebody else that's out there doing something that they shouldn't be doing, but I don't want to go into that tonight. If somebody else wants to bring it up, that's their business, but I'm going to stay away from that topic tonight, and I really don't have anything else to say. I was trying to think if there was anything interesting that I have come across lately, but if I do, I'll cut back in and ask to speak. Otherwise, I'm going to mute myself. I really do encourage you people out there to come in and talk. You know, we have this problem every week. And Bill threatens the same, and Lord knows we don't want that to happen. So, you know, y'all call in and participate in the program because I know a lot of you have interesting things to say. You know about things, and, you know, participate in the program because we don't want to lose these programs. Monday night and Tuesday night are, you know, are wonderful things, and we don't want to lose them. So, I'm encouraging everybody to call in and participate in these programs. You know, we're interested in everything y'all have to say. You know, if you don't do anything else but tell a joke, you know, at least it's participating. So, y'all do that tonight. Participate with us. Now, I'm going to shut up and let y'all have it. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. Praise Yahweh. And Gerald, I don't know what to tell you. I hope you make out. I hope that you find somebody that's willing to help share your place. I mean, it's a generous offer. You don't find it too often, right? A roommate with free room. But I'm sure he'll have to feed himself. But yeah, that's you know, it's but we're spread thin and we're few and far between. You know, it's not like a local Baptist church with 15,000 members in an 18,000 person community, and the only people that don't come to church are the Jews, right? That's the way it is. And I'm sure those Baptist churches, probably even some of the Jews show up just for the free chicken. Or I'm sorry, the free ham. But yeah, that's the way it is. We're spread thin and we're few and far between. And we can try to make a mention of it, you know, more often if you'd like. I mean, I have tried to reach out for you with a couple of particular individuals that just didn't seem interested in relocating to Louisiana. What can I say? But we'll pray for you, Terrell, and do our best. That's all I can help with.
Well, that's a lot, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate, you know, everybody's prayers. So I'm going to mute out and let y'all have it.
Okay, Terrell. You're breaking up anyway. Too bad now. I'm sorry. Clifton, I unmuted your microphone, hoping you'd talk to me, because nobody else seems to want to talk tonight.
Well, I'm here listening to you guys. I don't have anything particular to say. I did, though. I went to Bible Works, and I went to Genesis 1:26, where it has Adam without the article, you know?
Yes.
And I right-clicked on that and did a string search, and it took me to, it's in the Old Testament 367 times in 358 verses. So that could hardly be, you could hardly say that is creation of a Caucasoid.
Well, absolutely. It's the creation of the same Adam, right? Genesis 1:27 proves it. Some people are just very stubborn. They want to read that some alien belief into the Bible or some belief about aliens into the Bible, they're going to be able to do it. They're going to be able to twist some passage somewhere to fit their worldview. That's just the way it is. But the Adam of Genesis 1:26 and 1:27 is definitely the same Adam as Genesis 2:7 and Genesis chapter 5:1. I might be wrong. It might be the very end of Genesis chapter 4, but where it says that from the time of Seth, that Yahweh created them male and female and called their name Adam. It's the same Adam.
Well, ironically, the second place that exact word is used is Genesis 2:25, where Adam knew Eve and she bear Seth, I think it was. So how did it change from the first to the second place, in Caucasoid? In chapter 1, and then suddenly meaning Adam, and it had to be Adam, because who else could get Eve pregnant?
Well, right. Well, besides the serpent, right? They're taking for granted the Davies character that wrote this book 100 years ago is right, and Davies is a liar, and his whole book is based on a false premise. But it fits with their interpretation of Genesis, their pre-concocted interpretation, so they'll promote it. That's the way it is, and it's wrong. No race was created, but there's no record of any race of men created by Yahweh except for the race of Adam. Now, he must have created angels sometime before Adam, and we see that in you know, that angels aren't a part of that Genesis creation. But the Bible tells us explicitly that they fell from heaven, right? The fallen angels.
Yeah, and I think the we in verse 26 is Yahweh and the angels.
Well, yes, you know, it very well could be. The divine council, right? That many of the commentaries properly write about.
Yeah, anyway, I'm writing a paper on that now, and I'm getting to some interesting things. You know, there's one advantage to all this critical stuff, you know, and it forces a person to dig into a subject than he's ever gone before, and I kind of like that idea. I know that a lot of people don't like the arguing back and forth, but
Well, people that don't get the details need to be beaten ahead with the details, right?
Yeah, and I like to do that.
And there's a lot of people that want to accept fuzzy facts. And that aren't really facts at all because they're fuzzy, right? They want to state them as facts and they're fuzzy. Yes, Genesis 2:6 says Adam, and Genesis 2, I'm sorry, Genesis 1:26 says Adam, and Genesis 2:7 says Etha Adam. That is true. And Davies based his entire premise on that and purposely ignored Genesis 1:27 where it says Etha Adam. Well, yes, Paul. We if you read my papers, I conjecture, and Clifton states it too, that the fallen angels are probably the source for the other races, and the Book of Enoch alludes to that, but because it's just not explicit in the Scripture, some people just don't want to believe it. They want to look for the origin of some of the other races in the beast creation of Genesis 1:25. But just because there are bipeds thousands of years later who are called beasts of the field, that doesn't mean that those beasts of the field are part of that Genesis 1:25 creation. Because basically if you see something that's half person and half animal, what are you going to call it? Oh, you're an animal. Well, that doesn't mean that you're part of that original animal creation of God. It just means that you're an animal. So there's a lot of faulty thinking being done to support certain premises that it needs to be reviewed, and the people who are perpetrating it should either stop pushing their false view or look at this or take a more objective look. And it's a very divisive issue, and it's meant to be a divisive issue. We're either going to get the race thing right or we're not. If you look at any one of the other races and tell your children that God made them and they're good, well, how are you going to keep your children out of bed with them? You're not. That's the bottom line. You're not going to keep your children out of bed with them. God didn't make them. It's not in the Bible that he made them. And they ain't good. We could tell that just by looking at them.
Well, if they... they look like an animal, and they smell like an animal, and they act like an animal. Chances are they're at least part animal.
Yeah, right. And you never know what an animal smells like until you either go to the Bronx Zoo, to the simian cage, or the federal prison, and both smells are the same. Imagine that. I've been in both places.
Bill, in regards to the pronouncement of good, Eli's view on that, he and I were discussing this a few days ago, he said that saying that they are good, God is not pronouncing moral worth, he's simply saying that they were made correct for the intended purpose, that they were done correctly.
Yeah, well, what's that purpose? Where does it say in Scripture that God created other races in the first place? It only says that he created living things and four-footed beasts. How do we squeeze Negroes and Puerto Ricans into that? Because some of us want to squeeze Negroes and Puerto Ricans into that.
You know, I believe that at 1:26, you know, if you go to the lexicons, and there was a lot of smart men in England who worked on those. They really did a lot of good work on language, not saying that they were always correct. I mean, they did a lot. And so go to Brown, Drivers, Briggs, Gesenius lexicon, and the definition for Adam at 1:26 is Adam and Adam kind. So I think that the Almighty is saying, speaking to the angels, he's saying, let us make Adam kind in our image, meaning that Adam would have a lot of descendants and so on, and in speaking generally of a lot of people, and then the reason you got the article in 1:27, because he's speaking of a specific Adam.
Yes, Genesis 1:27 does prove beyond a doubt, in the Hebrew, if we want to examine Hebrew, the Genesis Adam of 1:26 is the same Genesis Adam of 2:7. Now Paul says that Adam, from whom sin came into the world, right? The Adam of Genesis chapter 3. Paul says that he is the first man, Adam. So there couldn't have possibly been another Adam before the first man, Adam. And
well, just the fact that they're using the article in 127, there can't, if he's the Adam, if you went into a furniture store and they got tables all over the place, you'd have to say you couldn't say unless you specified a special table in there, you couldn't say the table if there was a whole bunch of them in there. Now, but when you specify one, there can't be a cassoid that was Adam was made from.
Well, you know, Eli insisted there were white people here before Adam on this planet, and I agree. Eli tries to look for two creations of Adam, and I have to disagree because the scripture doesn't allow for it. The language and the grammar don't allow for it. However, it's very clear to me that there were white people here before Adam, and that's because the fallen angels were here before Adam, and the fallen angels had to be white. And if it was a third of the host of heaven, which is the poetic picture that Revelation 12, chapter 12 paints, well, that's no small number. I mean, that's got to be a significant number. Third of the host of heaven, I would think. I mean, I don't think Yahweh had nine angels. I mean, it's not a baseball team, right? And the first, second, and third baseman fell to earth. I think it was probably a significant number. And they had to be white if they were fallen angels.
Does it state in the Bible that sometimes we entertain angels unaware?
Yeah, right. That they were absolutely white. I mean, the men outside of Sodom didn't want to sleep with those angels in Lot's house because they look like short brown squat monsters. They had to be white. They were indistinguishable from other men.
Well, that would mean if we ever really met an angel, we wouldn't recognize him as an angel. He'd just look like another white man, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree wholly that there were white people long before Adam, and the only possible thing you can point to are the angels. And in 2 Peter and Jude, it says those angels kept not their first estate. You know, they left
wherever they were, whatever their station was, right, whatever their position or station was, and they fell into a worldly fleshly existence.
Well, it's strange that Jude groups, I think he groups three things together, you know. I think, isn't it Balaam and Sodom and Gomorrah and the angels that sent? It's all the same general topic there in Jude. So the angels had to do something very similar to what they were doing in Sodom and Gomorrah.
Well, right. Exactly. And you know, somebody... Paul Kersey just raised the point that maybe more whites were created when Adam was created. And that's a possibility. It's a possibility because Adam was given a garden to tend over, and I believe it had to be a garden of people. But Adam was the first man, Adam. He was the first Adamic man created. And he was the patriarch through whom we fell.
Well, there's a flaw in that. Now, if the Almighty created another Adam, he would have had to take a rib from Adam to make him.
But, well, right,
it's a,
right.
Because he had to do that to get Eve and see if Adam would have divorced Eve like he should have done. It really wasn't a rib. It's probably that curve thing it's talking about is his DNA.
Right, but now the point that's hard to get over is who Abel married, who Seth married, who Seth's sons married, and it's a difficult point to get around because we just don't have a complete picture. Scripture does not give us an exact scientific detail of the creation. It's basically, I see Genesis 2:4 through the end of chapter 4 as a parable. The complete picture just isn't there.
You know, a lot of people argue about who Seth married or who, of course, Abel didn't marry and so on like that. Well, and they would almost have married their sisters. And of course, you know, they'll cite the other passages where that's strictly against the law and everything like that. But you got to stop and think. The Almighty took some of Adam's DNA and made him a woman. Now, she was closer than a brother
sister.
Or sister. So the Almighty could have very well built in a factor that would allow for that for a couple, three generations till we got to start.
But, well, right. I'm not going to beat anybody over the head for imagining who Seth married, because we're just not told. What we have to believe is that Seth had a wife who was acceptable to God. And
well, I get a telephone call every once in a while, and they ask me, and I explain about Adam, you know, and the Almighty taking some of his DNA, and that Eve would be closer than a sister or brother, and they don't say anymore. So, you know, there might be somebody out there that
well, right. It is a showstopper, right? I mean, it does make people think. There's no doubt. However, Adam was the first man, Adam. And that's explicit. It's in Romans chapter 8. But we can't imagine there was another Adam before Adam. That's a foolish thought. Well, if we accept Scripture as true, and we should, it's our understanding that's wanting, because we don't have an entirely complete picture. But Adam was definitely the first Adam.
What I'm going to do is every place, those 367 times that the three-letter Adam, without the, ADM, without the article or the F, and what I'm going to do is check all of them to see what the context of each one of them is.
Oh, right. That's grunt work. I know how that is.
You know, you go through 367 of those to check out, see what the context is of each one. You kind of cover the subject. And I got a hunch there's people out there that they read a couple verses and that's all they do.
But let me go read Genesis 5, 1 and 2. This is the book of the generations of Adam. The day that Yahweh created man, in the likeness of Yahweh made he him. Male and female he created them, and blessed them, and called their name Adam in the day when they were created.
Incidentally, every one of those you quoted there is the three-letter word without the, the ADM, without the F or the article.
But well, so, right, and that illustrates how silly that article about Genesis 1:26 is. That argument about Genesis 1:26 is. An atom is an atom. It's nothing else but an atom. We can't make two things out of an atom. And Paul tells us that the atom that facilitated the fall was the first atom.
Well, I'd suggest more people get the program, if they can afford it, Bible Works, because you can find out a lot of things with that.
Well, right. It is. eSword is a good tool, and there are some other good tools that are free, but Bible Works is very thorough and complete. It's just too damned expensive because some Jew middleman is making way too much money. I wouldn't advise that anybody do anything illegal, but Bible Works is available free on a lot of torrents.
I'll tell you, if anybody wants to stop around at my house, I'll set them down by the computer, and I'll walk them through that and show you how. And on the program I got, and I think the one Bill got doesn't do it, but on mine, it'll turn the black Hebrew letters into red.
But it takes the search string and it makes it red in every verse it appears so that it stands out a lot more. Where in mine, it doesn't. The later copies, I have a later copy, and they removed that feature, so you actually have to read the Hebrew to find the string that you searched for.
Well, I kind of like that red feature.
Yeah, right, and they removed it. It's crazy, they removed it. I don't understand why they removed it. It was a good feature.
Well, maybe too many people were learning things with it that way.
Yeah, it works in Bible Works 6, but not in 7 or 8. So don't upgrade if you want to find it easier to read Hebrew the way it is, right? But to find your search string in the Hebrew.
Well, if you don't know the Hebrew real well, I'm not that good at it, but I can go in there and fish it, fish out the word I want. And once I have it, I highlight it and right click on it, and then pick out a string search. There's several other things you can do with it too. You know, I haven't learned everything I can do yet with that Bible verse.
Well, the bottom line is that the Adam of Genesis 1:26 and 27 is the same Adam as Genesis 2:7, and that's the same Adam as Genesis 5:1, and they're all the same Adam, period. There's one creation of Adam. It's described, that creation is described three times in three different ways, different facets and different reasons, and that's it. And we can't look for another creation of Adam before Adam. Because Paul tells us very clearly in Romans 8 that Adam was the first Adam. So I think that the argument that Genesis 1:26 is trying to create, so it is explaining, describing the creation of a pre-Adamic Adam is just sophism at the best. At best, it's sophist. It's sophistic.
Well, one thing that's free on the internet, and I have it on my website. I didn't make it up, but the guy allowed me to use it. Four different Bibles on there, and it's more complete than Esord, because Esord doesn't cover everything. It's on my website, and you can go there and pick out any verse and get an indication everything's there. It's there. There's a free. I mean, if you don't want to buy or not Esord, but BibleWorks, there's a free one that's online. That happens to be on Gerald's website, too, you know. Same Once Q Bible, and I forget what all the different ones are called. But,
The Q Bible program that was set up there. Yeah, there's links there on your site and on Gerald's, right? And on Israel Elect. QBible.com does it, too, right? That's where the original site is.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's a real good tool to study by.
Yeah. Well, yes. It's another way to get the Strong's numbers and to see the form of the Hebrew words when one needs to do that, if you can't afford or find a copy of Bible Works. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Bill.
How are we doing today? You have a question or something?
Yeah, I've had a couple I wanted to throw in there, but I'll wait until till the next one comes up. You already answered one.
Okay, well, I mean, nothing else can happen. I mean, unless people keep the program going by asking questions or making statements, right?
Okay. just so I understand, the Genesis 1:26, the way I understood it was that that was mankind and multiple people were made, multiple white people. But at the same time that Genesis 1:26 was made, the Adam of 2:7 was made, the specific person.
But, well, you know, Genesis chapter 1 tells a story that ends actually with Genesis chapter 2, verse 3, right? Chapter 2, verse 3 should be whoever made the verse and chapter divisions, they didn't do an ideal job, I don't think, anyway, and neither does Clifton or a lot of other commentators. That the Genesis 2, 3 should be the last verse in chapter 1, right? And that describes the creation of the overall creation of Yahweh, in summary, with the Adamic man as the pinnacle of that creation. That's what that describes. And the word in Genesis 1:26 for man is, let us create man, that word is Adam. The word in Genesis chapter 1, verse 27, that word is also Adam, but it's prefixed with the article. And it says, Eth Ha Adam, okay? Now, in Genesis chapter 2, we see the creation of Adam in detail. And Genesis 2:7 says that God created Eth Ha Adam. And we see that he's created, and we see the details, and we see what I believe is a parable describing the fall of the Adamic race through the sin of Eve and of Adam, okay? And that parable ends with the end of Genesis chapter 4. In Genesis 5:1, well, the end of Genesis chapter 4 describes what? The birth of Seth, after the death of Abel. And therefore we see basically a promise of the continuance of the race, right? Because we have a replacement for Abel. And then men began to call on the name of Yahweh when Seth had a son. Genesis 5:1 says, this is the book of the generations of Adam. As Clifton said, we do not see Eth-ha Adam, but what we do see is the same word used in Genesis 1:26, simply Adam. In the day that God created man, that day is not necessarily a literal 24-hour day. I mean, come on. We've already been told in Genesis chapters through the end of chapter 4 that Cain was born, that Abel was born, that they grew to manhood, that they made sacrifices to Yahweh, that Cain slew Abel, and that Seth was born, and Seth had a son named Enos, and he was born, and Cain had all kinds of descendants. So that word day cannot be taken literally. Only an idiot would insist on doing so. So what we see is the same description of the same creation in Genesis chapter 5. And that's, yeah, you know, it's the same words, Adam. So we have the same Adam and the creation. Remember that when these scrolls were written, they were all different scrolls. When it says this is the book in English, it should say this is the scroll in Hebrew. That's the word they used. So we see one scroll tells one story, and that's the creation story in Genesis chapter 1 through Genesis 2-3. We see another book or scroll tells another story, and that's the fall of our race in Genesis chapters 2 verse 4 through the end of chapter 4. And now this is another book or scroll. And then men come and put them together. And men did that. Men took the three scrolls, wrote them into books as we have them today. And then we have a whole bunch of simple-minded people insist that it's telling a linear story from verse to verse to verse to verse to verse, when it's obviously not. That's my position. Now we have, now another thing I'm going to say is, there are four entries for the word Adam in Strong's. And a lot of people would say, oh, there are four different words. Those people are simple-minded. Jim Wickstrom's one of them. I corrected Jim Wickstrom on this. I challenged him right on my open forum last year on TalkShoe, when I was holding this open forum on TalkShoe. Wickstrom had nothing to say to me, but he went on teaching the same old errors, and he still does today. He insists, oh, they're two different words for Adam because they're two different Strong's numbers. Well, if you examine all the nouns in Strong's, all the names in the Hebrew Bible, practically every one is two entries for, because a lot of those names are also regular Hebrew words. And we have in Strong's under Adam four words. They're all spelled exactly the same, but Strong's put them in four different categories, gave them four different numbers, 118, 119, 120, and 121. And the reason why he did that was to show that it was used as a verb. The word Adam is a verb. It was used as an adjective. It was used as a name. And it was used, you know, as a noun. And it was used as a proper name. That's why it's four different entries. But it's all the same word. Questions? I guess not. Well, that's my position. That's the scholarly position. Examine the words.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that more than the eighth day man position.
Well, right. There is no... I know there's people here. I mean, I love eighth day woman, but there's people here that were taught that and believed it. But Yahweh rested from all his works on the seventh day. That means... And we only see that at the end of Genesis chapter 1, where in the part of chapter 2 that should be chapter 1, right? And that, yeah, you know, that's an overall summary view. It's an introduction to our history, that first chapter of Genesis. And Adamic man is the pinnacle of Yahweh's creation. We are the pinnacle of Yahweh's creation. He rested from all his works after he created us. That doesn't mean that he's been laying in bed for 7,000 years. What that means is that no new species have been created by Yahweh since he created the Adamic man. All those fools that believe in evolution can wait and wait and wait. Nothing new is going to appear. Nothing new has appeared since we appeared. We're the newest thing here. we're the pinnacle of God's creation.
No, if anything, everything, we're devolving.
Exactly. Everything new that's appeared has been a corruption. I mean, have you seen the American Negro lately? They're just corruptions of Yahweh's perfect creation.
Well, if Eli's right that that Adam was made from a Caucasoid, that would be like retrofitting an automobile, wouldn't it? That would be changing the genes.
Well, right, but Eli's just wrong about this, because Adam, the Adam that sin came into the world through, Paul says that he was the first Adam. Eli's looking for Adams before Adam. He should have read Romans chapter 8. I'd rather pick Paul over Eli anytime. And I agree with Eli. Eli's looking to explain why white people were here before Adam. And it's just, there's a very simple explanation that's perfectly scriptural. There were white people here before Adam. They were fallen angels.
Well, one thing is a good thing to do before you write on a subject. And
read the whole Bible.
Right. And it's like in the Library Next digital library. Got a program that gives you cross references. Go to any verse, and it'll give you cross references all through the Bible to that verse.
Well, right, and it's a handy tool, and I miss it. I don't have it since I switched to Linux. I got one Windows computer left, and I got to get it installed over there. But that
anyway,
Libronix digital library, that's a tragedy to install, right? I mean, that's a horror to go to. It's an arduous. ARDUOUS. It's an arduous process installing Libronix.
But anyway, just using a Bible that has a good cross reference, you know, just go to all the cross references you find there anyway. Why go ahead right on a subject when you haven't really checked the whole Bible on it?
That's what you do when you're trying to prove something, and. You really think you have your mind made up about it before you've considered the entire scripture. And every time you do that, you're going to hit a wall somewhere.
Another good rule for a person who wants to be a scholar, when you get on subject, go to the first mention of that subject. It's what they call the rule of first mention. And everybody that's in Christian Israel Identity, and I don't call it CI, I call it CII. They should do that.
Well, they should. I mean, I can't tell you how many days I sat with the concordance or with the concordance to the Septuagint and checked every single entry on a word, and it would take all day, 4, 5, 6, 8 hours to check every single entry on a word and the context and the surrounding words and whether or not it has an article and what form of the verb it was, it's a very painstaking process.
Well, it's like if you want to study the word man and just go to the Strong's and look under, they've got a lot of entries under man, but there'll be, there's Knockery man and Adam man and all kinds of men in there, just plain Ish man. It must be 7 or 8 or maybe more than that, different numbers. Check on every kind of man. You're going to study on the subject of man, find out what the Bible has to say about all the different kinds of men. Instead of just writing something and picking it out of the clear blue sky and say, here it is, everybody's supposed to believe it. Now I figured it out, and they haven't figured out anything. Where's the scholarship?
Well, we certainly need some. That's what I would say. And we have to, but we have to set standards and maintain them, and seek to even rise above the standards that we set yesterday. I mean, that's what we have to look for better, right? And not look for easy and fast.
And see, another thing you can do if you have that eSword program, you can put in the search and type in the Strong's number. And you can go one by one, every place that verse is found. You generally do an Old Testament search and then maybe a New Testament search, depending on the word and so on. But they give you a choice there of doing a whole Bible search. Of course, that's confusing because the numbers for the Greek would interfere with the Hebrew number, and you wouldn't know what you're doing. So it's best to just do an Old Testament search and a New Testament search number, but you can go through and see exactly. You get a pretty good idea after a while why the translators translated some of the verses that they did. You know, they're not all right, of course, but after a while.
I forget who it was, but I remember once upon a time you queried me because you had a correspondent that was taking a Strong's number in Greek and applying the meaning of the definition of it to a Hebrew word.
I don't remember that one.
He was looking up a Strong's number in a concordance in the Old Testament, and then he took that number and ran off to the New Testament and looked up the Greek definition instead of looking up the Hebrew, and he was building a doctrine on top of that, on top of applying a Greek definition to a Hebrew word. that just because they both happen to have the same Strong's number, right?
And another thing that bears repeating is that when you're looking up stuff in Strong's, that when you come to the colon and the hyphen, that ends the definition, and after that, all that they have is the renderings in the King James Version, which, you know, a lot of them are right, but there's some there that's wrong. So you can't take the definition after the colon and the hyphen.
Right, everything after the colon-hyphen combination is simply the way the King James translated the word. Strong's explains that, and a lot of people just ignore his explanation and make doctrine out of basically what are errant King James translations in the first place. Yeah, you have to be careful the way you use books. Just having the books and being able to read the letters isn't enough.
And I would recommend that anybody that doesn't have one, and if they could afford it, get a Gesenius lexicon of the Old Testament.
Well, I have one somewhere, and it's a free PDF off the internet, right? And it didn't cost me a dime.
Yeah, I have one at Baker.
Yeah, Baker's the one that, you know, mine's a hard copy, and I wasn't aware that, you know, I wouldn't mind having that if it's electronic to, you know, you find a lot more things electronically than you try to read the whole book.
Yeah, that one's not available anymore.
But which one's that? Gesenius? I'm sure they sell it in stores.
Yeah. Not anymore. Not anymore. It was replaced with the BDB.
Oh, that's a surprise. I've always wanted one and never got a chance to buy one.
They still have some on Amazon. Used.
Yeah, I'm sure they probably want a pretty penny for them, right?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind having a DV. That would be a little, if they have a search on the DVD.
No, I have Gesenius' Hebrew grammar in PDF and not his lexicon. I don't think the lexicon is in here. I only have the grammar.
Gesenius goes even into the Arabic quite a bit. There's a lot of people that's not aware of it, but the Hebrew we have in our Bible is not complete. And most of your real good Bible scholars, when they can't find a root word, they go to the Arabic, find a root word.
Yeah, to try to understand the Hebrew word, right?
Yeah.
Because Arabic is a related language. I don't think it's perfect, but it's related.
But you know, the scholars back in the 18th and 19th century that were putting together a lot of these lexicons that we use. And they were pretty good scholars. The trouble of it is they didn't understand what we understand today, but they were pretty good language scholars. But we should always be looking out for the possible errors that they might have made.
Well, absolutely.
We don't have anything better to go by than what they produced. You know, some of those guys, they died before they got their work done. And another guy had to come along and finish it.
Well, you know, Strong took 20 years to make his concordance. 20 years to make Strong's concordance. It's no joke writing books by hand. I know. My New Testament took 4 years writing it by hand and rewriting it, a draft and then another draft and then a final version. And it takes some time, right? I really, doing that little book, I really had a lot of respect after that for people that wrote the big... My Liddell and Scott 9th edition lexicon is 2,000 pages, and those pages have really tiny print, and that there's a lot there, and I really have a lot of respect for those guys that did that sort of voluminous work by hand. My Hatch and Redpath Concordance of the Septuagint, Hatch and Redpath did that 100 years ago, and that's 1,000 pages. It's incredible. You're right, because when it took 30 years to make to do a project like that, a lot of times guys didn't see the other end of it.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hello, Mike. How you doing?
Pretty good. I brought my friend Dan in here tonight. Told him he was just talking about you guys. Saying, hey, you guys got a show going on tonight. Be a good time to jump in there.
Great. Open forum program. That's what it's for.
I'll try to keep as quiet as possible over here because, as you can tell, it's a little noisy in my area here.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, the sound of young white children is the sound of music, right? Nobody can protest that.
Exactly.
Hello, Dan. How you doing tonight?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Wonderful. Thank you. Oh, this is an open forum program. It's recorded, and I do it every Monday night. You're welcome to raise topics, and ask questions, argue, whatever you want to do.
Is there any topic of conversation for tonight?
Well, we were talking about Genesis, but we don't have to stay on it. I mean, we've already beat it to death, probably.
Bill, did you know, apparently, Google's terms of service don't allow you to talk about killing policemen on their blogs, and it seems that someone who didn't understand that, their blog is now history.
Yeah, well, that's good, but I really don't want to hear about it here, right?
All right, I just wanted to mention that.
What do you have for us, Dan?
Oh, not much, man. Not right now. I'm just making my way through some of those suggestions you gave me the other night. The seed lines, I'm on the second one right now. I made it through the introductory. I'm just making my rounds on the website.
Good. I'm glad you're reading.
Bill, why do you think the Germans allowed the British to escape at Dunkirk? Do you think it was a courtesy, figuring that the British would recognize it as such and agree to some sort of diplomatic resolution?
Well, because Hitler was still trying to make appeals to the English people based on kinship and blood, that they should be allies and not be at war with each other. And he let the Germans... The English escape at Dunkirk as a token of that. He didn't want to see 300,000 white men die for no reason.
They could have been taken prisoner, though, couldn't they?
He wanted to show the English that he was their friend, that they had a filial relationship that he understood. Of course, the English preferred Jewish money to German blood.
So they repaid his friendship with injuries.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Sword, let me just mention war historian Bill Hart also.
Say again.
Yeah, you're breaking up there.
Yeah, I'm using Bill's headset here. I'm not sure if it's working. Oh, okay. Little Hart, the British historian, he draws the same conclusion.
He's saying that Liddell Hart, the British historian, drew the same conclusion I did, but I never read his work, so they're independent conclusions.
He basically wanted to appeal to the English to end the war and just make up be friends.
You know, speaking of Hitler, me and Dan were having a conversation the other night. Kind of maybe not so much an argument or anything, but a difference of opinion, and maybe he can clarify a side on this. But would you consider Hitler losing World War II, or would you say that he somehow won something there in World War II? Because the argument is that the fighting these Jews sometimes doesn't seem to be a productive thing, and I'm wondering, well, I don't see any other way out of it. You know, it's when the day comes that they're just going to give up power. I mean, I'll let Dan clarify.
Yeah, let Dan clarify, because the question's really ambiguous the way you framed it. I'm sorry.
I'm gonna need about a minute here. I got some tea boiling. You won't be able to hear me that well. I think basically I was just asking. Well, I started out by saying that I didn't know enough to really formulate my own opinion yet, because all I know of World War II and Hitler is basically mainstream and, you know, just not much more outside of that. The question was, if, you know, what was really accomplished? And the overall gist of things, you know, from an outside view looking in, is Germany and those, you know, the states surrounding in a better off position than they were than before he came? Or, you know, I mean, do they just, are they further in control now?
Well, they're a lot further in control now. I mean, there was no Holocaust. That's just bullshit. And 6 million Jews have a free ticket on Anglo-Saxon blood. The Jews sought world dominion, and Hitler and Germany stood against it, while America and England just sold themselves off to the Jews as whores. And that's basically what happened in a nutshell. And the House of Rothschild was in full control of the Soviet Union. That's my contention.
That's kind of what I was seeing, was they, the powers that be, the Rothschilds, the family, the Jews, bankers, whatever you want to call them, it seemed to me that they had a fair amount of control, or a lot of control at that time, and I don't know, or I don't see that they lost any of that.
They gained more control. The Jews tightened their grip on control. They tightened their control on Christianity.
So that's what I see. So then my question then is, what good did Hitler do?
Well, you know, the man stood up for his race and his nation. Should Germany be whores for the Jews and bend over and take it in the ass just because the Jews want to run the world? We did.
No,
we in America did that. We did that. We're whores.
Yeah,
but Germany wasn't going to put up with it. Hitler stood up against the Jews.
Now, isn't it true that how did he come to power? I know it's been said that he was, you know, helped with the financiers, you know, the...
Well, no. You know, none of that is underhanded. None of Hitler's assistance from international industrialists was underhanded. The industrialists in America and in Germany and in France and in other places that supported the Nazis, you know, those industrialists, a lot of them were Jews, but they didn't know that the Rothschilds controlled Bolshevik Russia. They didn't know that. They didn't know this was all a move on the part of the Rothschilds to control all of Europe, which is exactly what it was. They were not aware of that. They were afraid of Bolshevik Russia. Joseph Stalin made many open statements that he was going to conquer all of Europe, okay? And the German people knew what went on in Bolshevik Russia in the teens and the 20s. And they were in abject fear of the same thing happening in Germany. The Jews were in control of Germany in the Weimar Republic, but the Free Corps had put down several communist uprisings in Hamburg, in Munich, in Vienna. The Jews couldn't pull their communist anarchy bullshit, okay? And I'm just being frank. Now, the Jews took control of the Weimar Republic anyway, very much like they took control of America in the 30s. And Adolf Hitler stood up against that and rallied the German people who were in fear of Bolshevik communism. Now, Hitler's industrialist supporters supported him because he was the only choice against the communists. He was the only politician in Europe who was successful in standing up against communism. And they understood that an investment in him was a protection of their interests in factories and in corporations and in intellectual property in Germany.
I heard the rounding of the so-called rounding up of Jews, there was a lot of businessmen that were controlling that area, right? That basically they were controlling the economics status of the country at that time. Are those the Jews that they were just trying to round up and get out of, you know, take them out of power?
Well, Hitler had a Jewish problem, and the industrialists ignored Hitler's rhetoric concerning the Jewish problem in order to protect their investments. Because what's more important to even to a Jew than his money? If the Bolsheviks succeed in taking over in Germany, the capitalist Jews lose everything. So it's natural for a capitalist in America with factories in Germany to support Hitler because Hitler is a respecter of property rights. He wasn't the madman he's made out to be, and he worked very well with the industrialists. He didn't seek to take anybody's property away. He only sought to remove the Jewish criminal element from Germany. And it just so happened that most of the communists and most of the anarchists happened to be Jews. It's the Rothschilds that produced all the anti-Hitler propaganda in the Jewish world from the time Hitler rose to power, and that's because they knew that they had no chance of controlling Germany with Adolf Hitler in power. Hitler wasn't going to have a Jewish-controlled central bank. If Hitler was a Jewish agent, he just would have had a Jewish-controlled central bank. There would have been no need for a Second World War. The Jews would have controlled Germany just like they controlled... The Rothschilds would have controlled Germany just like they controlled England and America.
Is it true that he was starting to print his own money?
Hitler did print his own money. What's the sin about that? The Jews print their own money. That's why there was a war. That's why there was a war.
I get that. I see that clearly. I'm just asking questions here. I have no problem believing that. That
we should be printing our own money.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, my basic question was just, you know, what was the overall positive? Are they in a better situation now?
None of us are in a better situation because Germany lost.
Yeah.
Yahweh said the beast would do, our kingdom would be handed over to the beast. Hitler didn't understand the scripture, or else maybe he would have known he shouldn't fight the war. But that doesn't make us any less the sinners. That doesn't, because Yahweh said the kingdom would be handed over to the beast. It was inevitable, but that doesn't make us any less culpable. We played the whore for the Jew, and we still do today, and so did the British people.
Well, I see that, absolutely. No, that was again what I was discussing with Mike. You know, I was asking how do you play this out? You know, because I hear a lot of times, you know, I can't wait for this to come down. I can't wait for the, you know, the fighting and all. And I don't know. I mean, at wartime, from what I see, there's always loss. You know, so from my perspective, at this point, whenever you have to go to war, you never, you know, even if you win, you still don't win because you're still going to lose something.
So, well, we shouldn't take the scripture into our own hands. Yahweh says that the time's going to come when all his enemies are going to be destroyed, and whatever vehicle he wants to do that by, when it happens, when that time comes, we're all going to know it, and it's going to be successful, and there's going to be no doubt about it. But we can't take things into our own hands because vengeance belongs to our God. And when it's all said and done with, all the world's Jews will fit into the little Volkswagen. There will be a mass conversion.
Yeah, and I say it in a sense that the battle comes. I know tomorrow will be a better day. You know, like get the battle over with so that we can continue on without dealing with them anymore. Not in the sense that taking measures in their own hands by any means, but.
But, well, absolutely. But, yeah, you know, our people obviously haven't been chastised enough because they're still worshiping the Jew. They don't even know they're being chastised. They don't even know their own nation is being has been given away right out from under them. That they've been disenfranchised in the civilization that their own fathers fought and died and for and built with their own hands. And white Americans and white Europeans have been totally disenfranchised from their own civilization at the whim of the Jew. They don't even know they're being punished. So how could they turn to God if they don't know they're being punished? That the day's going to come when they will turn to God because they will have no other choice.
That's unfortunate. They got to wait till then.
Well, you know something? That they deserve everything they get as long as they're sitting in front of their televisions worshiping Jews and Negroes. Tell me that's not the worship of the beast.
No, I don't disagree with you at all there.
Hey, Bill, begs the question, how do you present other people to others about this message by convincing them of the lawlessness of the other races?
Ask them about the creation and sustenance of civilization. That's the best place I ever thought to go with it, with a person that's totally in tune with the mainstream. You know, ask them to look at Philadelphia. I used to talk to people from Jersey, and I used to tell them, hey, would you walk through Harlem tonight? And they'd say, hell no. Would you walk through Bedford-Stuyvesant? Hell no. Will you walk through Newark after 10 o'clock at night? Hell no. Well, would you walk through Hillside or Point Pleasant or Toms River, white communities, right? Of course they would. They'd feel right at home. They'd have no problem. No crime, no problem. Or drive through Philadelphia. Take a ride through North Philly. It's a war zone. Every other house is shelled out, and there's people living in shelled out houses. Black people. Look at what they did to the neighborhoods in Newark and in Hoboken. They're destroyed. Well, now the yuppies have repatriated a lot of them, but we could point to other places in New York and New Jersey and Philadelphia and look at what the aliens have done to them. They can't sustain a civilization. We give them jobs, we give them welfare, we give them all this money, we give them all these benefits, we give them a packaged civilization, and they destroy it. And look at what they've done in Africa. That wherever they go, they bring Africa. Wherever the Mexican goes, he brings the barrio. They create it everywhere they are. If people can't see that, they don't deserve to wake up. They deserve to be punished some more. It's plain and simple. How much crime is in black neighborhoods? And how much crime is in... Well, look at Switzerland. Everybody has a gun. Nobody kills each other. Look at Idaho. Everybody has a gun. Nobody kills each other. Nebraska. Look at D.C. Everybody has a gun, and nobody with any common sense wants to even go out at night. The ability to live peaceably amongst each other and but whether we're rich or we're poor, I mean, you could go to a trailer park in Kansas where there's all white people and they're not trying to kill each other. And it's a trailer park. White people don't act like the ones you see on Jerry Springer. White people, there's no white crime. But there's extremely little crime up here in upstate New York. Extremely little. And it's a big thing. It hits the front page of all the papers when somebody rips off some lottery tickets from a gas station. That's the worst thing that happens up here. And it's all white, and they all got guns. They all hunt. They all shoot. You go down the city and look at what goes on. It's there's so many obvious facets and to the racial issue and civilization in our culture right in front of our eyes. And if they can't open their eyes to that, then they don't. That they deserve to be punished some more. And in fact, I think they should probably go live with some Negroes if they love them that much. That they should probably move to Bed-Stuy or Fort Apache.
Yeah, they'll say that's true about the black. They may even admit that. But the Asiatics, they may not admit it to.
But well, then they've got to take a good walk through Chinatown and see how those people live like pigs. 26 of them in a 3-room apartment. They hot swap bunks so that they could get off to the restaurant to do their shift. And there's more crime in the Asiatic communities, and there's probably as much crime as there is in the Negro communities, but they're more cunning about it. You'll find that they're into crime. They're not into holding up liquor stores with Saturday night specials, right? That they for a bottle of Thunderbird and $20 worth of cigarettes. That they'd rather pull off identity theft and white collar scams and things like that. But there's just as much crime in Asiatic communities, and there's just as little civilization in Asiatic communities. Chinatown is filthy. You walk down the back alleys in Mott Street, it's filthy. They're pigs. They live like pigs. They have an entirely different set of standards than we do. And they don't like white people either. They're just a little smarter and craftier than the Negro. They know that the white people's business is what gets them to buy their next Chinese restaurant. Without our business, they can't open up their franchises.
I love how they sound loaded with MSG too. All that Chinese food. Just dousing us with poison.
Yeah, they'll poison the hell out of you. Look at what they did to the dog food. Look at how many recalls of food we get from China. I wouldn't eat anything made in China. Or in a Chinese restaurant here.
No, what did they have? The milk? I even heard reports of years ago, like one of those baby carousels, the things that you hang in the cribs, and behind the recording of the music, it was like whispering, "I hate you," And now I can't validate that, but I heard that, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. Target and Walmart.
Well, the bottom line is that if the Chinese can make an extra dollar by poisoning us or selling us substandard products, shit that's going to break, stuff that's going to hurt people, they don't care about that. They only care about the extra dollar they were able to make from us by taking this ingredient out, by cutting that ingredient down, by substituting this protein with some chemical substance that emulates protein in tests but really poisons us and shuts down our liver, and that they'd rather make the dollar. They don't care about the consequences. They have no guiding moral principles, and they never will. Yahweh's laws just aren't written in their hearts. They never will be. They never created a civilization in China, ever. What they did was the Jews exported our civilization to China and told the Chinese that they could profit very handsomely by mimicking it. That's what they've done. A lot of these goods that you see made in China, they're actually made in work that they're in kind of like slave factory slave or enforced labor complexes. I read about these complexes in the Wall Street Journal. I have the article somewhere. The Jews on Wall Street were bragging about these dormitories and factory units that were being constructed throughout China, where you would have a factory in a remote area and dormitory space with a food court in a mall for 8,000 workers that live on cots with lockers just like prisoners in federal prison live. And they get up in the morning and they run off to their work, and then they could go to the food court in the mall and go back to their little room with their little cot in their locker.
Walmart, there was somebody, I know it wasn't Walmart, but somebody put out a documentary, I think it was called The High Cost, or something like that, in the title of Walmart, and they addressed those conditions, how they charged workers for their cot space, whether they used it or not.
Yeah, right. It's really like a slave labor camp. That's what they are. They're like prison factories. That's exactly what they are. And they're spread throughout China. And these Chinese people that are in the rice paddy that have never needed anything for 2,000 years except to be left alone to grow their rice so they could feed their kids and live in their straw hut, because that's all they'll ever have is a straw hut until they get some American ingenuity there. And that these Chinese people are compelled to leave the rice paddy and go work in these factories and sleep on cots in prison, what basically amounts to a prison dormitory, and they're a captive labor market. And the Jew has basically enslaved the entire company to the pursuit of more U.S. bonds. More phony U.S. bonds, too, by the way. The only reason why we have anything in China is because the Jews brought it to them. The horrors of international capitalism. We've sold our souls to the Jew, and the Chinese have our asses. Yeah, it's pretty bleak, right? I mean, people deserve their punishment. I ain't going to cry about it. It's Yahweh's will. When our people wake up and realize that Yahweh is sovereign, that then he'll lift these beasts from us and he'll lift this punishment from us. It's very clear in Scripture.
So this is already all written out and we're just playing it?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that we have to see it, but that doesn't mean we have to like it. And we have to, we have a responsibility to show our brethren the way to the kingdom of heaven. And that's the only way that is the obedience to God and his laws. And racial separation, which is among his laws. If you separate yourself from the system and you practice obedience to your God, that there's a promise in that you won't suffer the punishments of the world. But we have to determine who we're going to pursue the worship of, God or Mammon. Okay, we got to keep this moving along here. I mean, these moments of silence, I didn't think I was that bad, but somebody should have something to say.
I'm just chewing on a lot of what you've been throwing my way.
Yeah, there's nothing to add. It couldn't be said better, Bill.
Well, then let's change the subject. Let's talk about, I don't know, it's snowing here again. It's been snowing all day. I think Papa Cat wished it all on me. He's been asking me for days how much snow I have, and now I have snow.
I wish we had some more.
I'm sorry, John, can you speak up, please?
Yeah, Bill, I have a question. What do you think about the Testament of Dan? Eli's been doing it.
You know, it's been a long time since I read the Testaments of the Patriarchs. But what they are is they are second century apologetic works. They were written in the second century B.C. But with almost all likelihood, I do not accept any of the Testaments of the Patriarchs to be legitimately from the Patriarchs. And being able to demonstrate, as I did with Greg in the Testament of Judah, that there are conflicts with Scripture and some of the content of the Testaments, then I can't accept them as canonical, right? I think that they might give good insight, and it's important, especially in the racial issues, because it does come up several times in the Testaments. They give good insight into the minds of Christians, and I do mean Christians, in the 2nd century B.C., on the matters in question. But there's still, that they're not legitimate testaments of the actual patriarchs, that they're simply an elaboration by someone in the 2nd century B.C. that thought he had to help God, right? I mean, there's a lot of apocryphal works that are apocryphal for a reason, because they're definitely not legitimate scripture.
Is that where the statement that Levi will be provoked against you?
I'm not sure. I would have to look it up. It's been about 10 years since I've read them.
So, I mean, that's in the scripture at all? I mean, I don't know if that's in the scripture. Is that in the scriptures at all, or is it just in the Testament of Dan, as far as I know?
Well, it's not in the Old Testament scripture. It's definitely not in the Old Testament. There's no that I ever read that it says that the house of David is provoked against Judah in Jeremiah, but there's nothing in the actual scripture that would indicate the truth of that. I don't remember reading anything about Levi being provoked against Judah. Only the house of David, and that's in Zechariah chapter 12, I believe. I'm going to try to look for that. And I believe that this is an eschatological prophecy that probably describes the happenstances of this past century. Zechariah chapter 12, from verse 4. In that day saith Yahweh, I will smite every horse with astonishment and his rider with madness, and I will open mine eyes upon the house of Judah, and will smite every horse of the people with blindness. And the governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be my strength in Yahweh of hosts, their God. In that day I will make the governors of Judah like a hearth of fire among the wood, and like a torch of a fire in a sheath, and they shall devour all the people round about on the right hand and on the left, and Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. Yahweh shall, and it doesn't mean the physical Jerusalem, right? It doesn't mean that city in Kikistan. Yahweh shall also save the tents of Judah first, and the glory of the house of David, and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah. And I think that it shows that there's this division between the house of David and the tribe of Judah in the end of days. But I don't see anything that ever describes Levi being stationed or pitted or adversarial to Judah at any time. I mean, that's evidently something that's apocryphal that should probably stay there, because there's no indication of it in Scripture.
Yeah, I see. I thought it might have been just non-scriptural. But what about the Book of Esther? Now, why was it canonized if really there are no real cross-references between it and other Scriptures?
Well, Esther's a phony book, but the Jews love it. So why do you think it was canonized?
Because the council, was it Council of Nicaea? I'm not sure if they decided that issue there, but they must have been influenced.
Well, I think there was a lot of undue influence at the Council of Nicaea when counting the canon. But I don't know if Esther was canonized there, but it was definitely included in Jerome's Vulgate, right? I'm not sure if it was if it was canonized at Nicaea or not. It was definitely included in Jerome's Vulgate in the 5th century. And from what I understand, I mean, Comparé's written on this and some other writers. I don't know it firsthand, but from what I understand, Esther was not a part of the Eastern Orthodox canon until fairly recently. The fact is that Esther is not a historical figure. Esther never existed as a person.
Well, some people might say that, well, how can you know that?
How can I know that? Well, first, aside from the fact that there's absolutely no references to Esther anywhere else in Scripture, right? The events of Esther were allegedly at a time, occurred at a time in the reign of King Xerxes. I think it was the 5th year, the 6th year, that it was just, it was just before the commission of Ezra to Jerusalem. Yet Ezra makes not one mention of any of the events in the book of Esther. Now, I know that a lot of mainstream historians, they try to place Nehemiah as following Ezra. But it can be proven, and I've done it, and Clifton's seen the work, and Clifton's reproduced it. It can be proven that Nehemiah was actually the governor of Jerusalem under the Persians until 490 B.C., when he was recalled. And that's the year that the Battle of Marathon was fought. Ezra received his commission in the 7th year of Artaxerxes, which was actually around 458, 457 B.C., and there was a large gap between Nehemiah and Ezra because that was the period in which the Persians put all of their energy and resources into the invasion of Greece, which we see failed, right? And public works projects weren't taken up again for some years after the failed invasion of Greece, which didn't finally fail until the defeat at the Battle of Mycale in 468 B.C. Now, it's apparent to me, and I could prove from internal evidence in Ezra and Nehemiah, that Ezra followed Nehemiah, and the events in Esther supposedly took place just before the time of Ezra. Now, why didn't Ezra ever mention the events in Esther? He never did. And we don't see them mentioned. We have a very thorough knowledge of that portion of Persian history, and we have not one whit of substantiating or corroborating evidence for the events of the Book of Esther ever having taken place in that period, even though the Greeks recorded that period, and we have Persian inscriptions from that period, and we have a voluminous a great volume of work of evidence supporting the history of that period. Not one shred of evidence of any of the events described in Esther exist outside of the Book of Esther itself, which seems to me to be a historical novel written by Shlomo Kikstein, probably in the 3rd or 4th centuries B.C. I'm kidding, right? But it's a historical novel written, devised by, or I should say contrived by the Jews, that made its way, there's no doubt it made its way into the Jewish mainstream writings and into the temple literature by the time of Josephus, because Josephus accepted the historicity of the Book of Esther. But I don't, and I can't. Now, there's much internal evidence that Esther's a fraud. And part of the internal evidence is that there was a public decree issued in the first month of the year that in the 11th or 12th month of the year, all the Jews were going to be killed. Now, what would happen in this country if we made a public decree this month that in 10 or 12 months all the Negroes are going to be killed? There'd be huge riots in the street, right? I mean, the Negroes aren't going to stand around for 10 months or 11 months or 12 months and do nothing, are they? But there's much internal evidence in Esther that the book is a fraud. Now, the name Esther is cognate with the Babylonian name Ishtar. And some people might say that that's a coincidence. Well, the name Esther is certainly not a Hebrew name, right? Now, Esther had an uncle named Mordecai. And that name is cognate with the Akkadian word Marduk. And Marduk in Akkadian and Babylonian theology was basically, or I should say cosmology, was basically Marduk and Esther were cousins, and in the Book of Esther, Marduk is Esther's uncle. Very similar relationship. Esther is a historical novel written and named after the characters in the Babylonian pantheon, and it was written by Jews, and it's a novel.
Also, Esther was supposed to have been of the tribe of Benjamin, and even though the king of Persia would have been white, a female Israelite was not to marry out of tribes, or she would lose her position.
Clifton.
Any children born to her would not come under the covenant.
And I'm glad you went there, Clifton, because that made me remember something that I forgot, because I'm operating on my feeble memory here. That from the time of Darius, right, there was a law in Persia, that and Herodotus describes it, that the Persian kings, I'm pretty sure Herodotus describes it anyway, that the Persian kings can only take as a queen a woman from one of those seven noble families of Persia who had assisted the families of the men who had assisted in recovering the Persian throne from the Magi, who's known to the Greeks as Pseudo-Cambyses. Okay? There was a Magi usurper to the throne after the death... Pseudo-Smerdis. After the death of Cambyses, a Magi supposedly usurped the throne of Persia and played the role of Cambyses' dead brother, Smerdis, claiming to be Smerdis. So the Greeks call him Pseudo-Smerdis. And Darius, the story goes that Herodotus records is that Darius and six other men from noble Persian families go to the castle and to the royal palace and confront this Smerdis and remove him from power. And Darius is chosen to be the king out of all of these families under the agreement that the king of Persia would only take as a wife one of the daughters from their families. Okay, and that was an agreement among the noble families of Persia, and the subsequent Persian kings weren't allowed to marry outside of those seven families due to that agreement. Well, Esther violates that. And both Daniel and Herodotus, Daniel the prophet and Herodotus, both say that the laws of the Persians can never be altered, not even by the king. And there's a clear instance in Daniel where that takes effect, where the king issues a law that can't be changed, okay? And Daniel has to go into the furnace, or I'm sorry, into the lion's pit. Daniel has to go into the lion's pit, because even though the Persian emperor wants to give him clemency, he can't, because the law of the Persians can never, ever be changed. They have to abide by it once it's created. Now, Esther, and Herodotus supports Daniel. Herodotus makes an explicit statement that the laws of the Persians can never be changed for any purpose. Now, Esther, in the Book of Esther, the Persian emperor just flippantly changes the law. He issues a decree and a law, and it's just changed. And that is contrary to the testimony in both Daniel and in Herodotus. Basically, the Book of Esther, it is bullshit. And there's much other internal evidence besides that. But at every turn, there are serious problems with this book, and it even conflicts other scripture.
Well, thank you, Bill. If that doesn't explain it, I don't think anything will.
But some people say Artaxerxes was the king during the period of Esther. Some scholars, I should say, claim it was Artaxerxes. Well, if it was Artaxerxes, then why didn't Ezra mention the events in Esther? And some people say it was Xerxes and not Artaxerxes. And they say that to try to let Ezra off the hook. Well, if it was Xerxes, and we look at the chronology given in Esther, then in the year that Xerxes is supposed to be getting married to Esther, he's really standing on the shores of Salamis watching his navy go down in flames. So it's not, you know, the book's a novel. There's tons of evidence against it. And I have more, but this is only what comes off the top of my head. So I don't, you know, a lot of CI pastors love the book of Esther, but it's garbage. Yes, Eighth Day Woman, I believe that Susanna is one apocryphal book that's probably legitimate. And Susanna probably belongs as the preface to Daniel. And if you go back and look at the Daniel series that Eli and I did, I prefaced Daniel with Susanna.
Bill, I have a question about the origins of English. I got a response from that Hungarian woman. It was a woman, by the way. And she finds it hard to believe that English is from Hebrew. I got this email from her. And she said she'll contact you as well. She says English is formed from other Germanic languages and Saxony with strong French influence in its initial period. From what I've heard, that English is a Germanic language.
Yeah, well, German is a Hebrew language. English came from German, yeah. And French came from German and Latin, right? French doesn't exist without German and Latin. All right, so I won't even go there, right? I mean, yeah, we got a lot of our screwed up pronunciations from the French. We got that damn letter J from the French. I hate it. John, nah, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Yeah.
The French, all they did was twist German and Latin, right? They twisted them into a pretzel and they call it French. I'm biased, right? Can't you tell? The German language has a lot of cognates in Hebrew. And that's why English has a lot of cognates in Hebrew. And I don't know German personally, so except for a very small vocabulary and what I've seen in some books, so I don't include it. But look on the front page of Christogenia. There's an entire English from Hebrew section where there's 1,000 words, English words that are cognate, that have Hebrew cognates. Words that sound alike with the same definitions or related definitions. I don't know how that could be disputed. That goes way beyond loan words, right? Sure, there's a couple of cinnamon is one of them, loan words into English from Hebrew. But we have many basic building block words that are clearly cognate with Hebrew words. There's no way this woman can explain that.
Well, she seems to. She did visit your site, and she dismisses these cognates. She said, you awkwardly try to prove these ideas that Aleph, for example, the A letter in Hebrew, is the same as Alpha in English.
That's because it's the same as Alpha in Greek, right?
Well, that's what I mean. I know it comes from Greek, but. It's apparently, she says the word is directly imported from Greek, therefore unfounded assertion. So she's making a big mistake that she doesn't know that Greek is also from Hebrew.
Well, exactly. But my site, it shows not only English Greek words that are from Hebrew, but also a bunch of Greek words that are from Hebrew and Latin words, right? I'm right at A right now, right? The Hebrew word agora, which means something gathered, also describes a market in Hebrew, all right? But the Greek word agora is a market, and that's a whole bunch of stuff that's been gathered, right? And the Hebrew word agar, which means to gather, is the Greek word agairo and agar in Latin. And this agairo is a verb which means to gather in Greek. And that is a Hebrew word agrof, which means a clenched hand or a fist, and garath, which means to take off or bear off violently, and karab, which means to approach, and I would equate that to the English words grope, grab, and the German word graben, and the Latin word capere, which is actually probably a lot closer than it appears on the surface. And that's that this I got 1,000 words like that. Yeah, you might be able to dismiss 10 of them, but you can't dismiss 500 of them. And other Hebrew scholars have seen my site and argued that same point with me. But when I explained that to them, they just went away. They just went away.
How about, she says also the word mata in Hebrew, to mat, I'm not sure, or matter, you say, and mutter in Portuguese, in English. Now, I mean, I'm sorry, English is like a second language to her, so she's not making this very clear. So the word matter in English came from the word mata in Hebrew, which means what?
It means downward, below, or belief. And I believe that the words mat, matter, and mutter all come from that same idea. To mutter is to speak downward or below. To matter is a matter is the basis of something, which is the foundation, which is the same idea as downward, below, or beneath. And that's the word mat, which is under our feet. It's the idea that spawns the word that's just as important as the word itself when looking at how language develops.
Well, she claimed that each one of these words that you present is really just semantic origin and a different meaning and cannot serve as examples of derivatives.
But, well, it's 1,000 words with very close meanings. I mean, she could go fly a kite, too, but that ain't going to bother me either. I mean, if she wants to disagree with me for the sake of disagreement, that's fine. But you can't 500 similar words and definitions, that's not a mistake. Well, yeah. What about the word machine? What about mechi and machine and the Greek words mechane and mechanomahi and the Latin words machina and machinare? What about what about the Hebrew word mutah and 4297, which means a stretching or a distortion, and the Greek words mutilate and mutate? I mean, tell me that didn't come from that Hebrew word. But what about the Hebrew word metil, an iron bar, and the English word metal? And that's not a Greek word, and that came directly from Hebrew. And that's exactly what it means. So the English didn't have any metal without Jews? Is that what they're saying?
All very good points. She's engaging in what... she's basically dismissing what you're saying.
Without
investigating.
She should read the whole list and consider them all, but she's a Jew and she doesn't want to consider them all.
Okay, yeah, she also says, like, it would be similar. Your argument, basically, according to what she says, be something similar to a Brazilian who listened to the city named Boston and said the word means bosta, which means shit. And that's an argument that's totally, unsubstantiated. But, you know, of course,
if there's 100 cognates here, out of this list of 1,000, if 500 of them are valid, if 100 of them are valid, we have to look at the origin of English. Because they're not loan words, they're basic words. I mean, mara is a vision in Hebrew, and it's a mirror in English. How could they not be the same word?
Right.
If marad is to rebel in Hebrew, it's a marauder in English. It's to maraud. How could they not be the same word? If mashal is to rule in Hebrew, how is it not the source of the English word marshal?
Well, it's good points for me. However, you know, what she's also suggests at the end is to visit the Department of Letters at any university and talk to the teachers responsible.
Which are all Jews. Well, screw every one of those kike bastards. I ain't talking to none of them. I got my own letters. I could read letters. I mean, there's only 26 of them. Of course they're going to follow the Jew the Jew paradigm. As soon as they buck the Jew paradigm, that they're defunded totally.
Yeah, well, we all know that here.
But screw that Jew whore. I ain't changing a damn word. English comes from Hebrew. That's the bottom line. I ain't letting a Jew dictate to me what I see with my own eyes.
Let me just inform you, Bill, that she comes from a Zoroastrian influence.
Yeah, okay, so she's a Jew and a New Age freak. I'm being serious. I'm not just being a pain in the ass on purpose. Zoroastrianism is Zoroaster was probably an Israelite and probably was trying to recodify Hebrew cosmology on different terms, right?
How did we get removed from Hebrew in the first place?
The Assyrians deported us. That they took us off. They took us out. Language evolves. The Phoenician Israelites are the people that brought English to England, right? And the Israelites of the Assyrian deportations are the ancestors of the German people.
Do you know how it started that we started reading from left to right versus the other?
Well, you know something? In the ancient world, not all Hebrew was written right to left. That's how. Because it was written left to right and right to left. In fact, sometimes it was written in both directions on the same inscription. And that's called Boustrephedon, which means as the cow turns or as the steer turns. Well, when you plow a field, you go from one side to the other. Then you don't go back to the first side and start over. You just plow backwards. And that's there's many inscriptions that were found Boustrephedon, meaning the top line was written from left to right, and you drop to the next line and you write from right to left. The order of the letters didn't mean as much to them as it did to us today. In fact, every other sentence in your book should be backwards. It would be easier to read. I can read backwards. I mean, you got to train yourself a little bit, but you should be able to do it.
Nice. I never heard it before.
Yeah, so the Greeks, if you look at the earliest Greek vases, and you can find them right on Wikipedia, just look at Greek pottery, and you'll see words written right to left. But most Greek was written left to right. The earliest Greek vases were written right to left. So at one time, the Greeks must have wrote right to left.
All that Jewish bitch wanted, she was afraid that somebody was going to destroy her God's chosen people claim.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what it comes down to. She's dismissing 500 or 1,000 cognates as coincidences. Well, that's nice. Trying to say that certain ones don't add up. Well, the list isn't perfect. So if half of them are wrong and there's 1,000 cognates there, well, I still got 500. So if the Hebrew word nazah, and the Hebrew word nazal, nazal means to spurt or sprinkle. Nazal, N-A-Z-A-L, to drip or shed by trickling. If that's not the origin of the English word nasal, I'll jump off my roof right now. Of course, I live in a one-story ranch, but... Look it up, Strong's number 5140, N-A-Z-A-L, nasal. To drip or shed by trickling. That's the English word nasal. That's the English word nose, and that's the English word nozzle. And the Latin word nosus, which means the same thing. And English comes from Hebrew, and that whore is an idiot.
Or maybe she's just mistaken, and she wants to believe what she wants to
believe. Well, she has an agenda, and that's all she has is an agenda, right? She doesn't care
exactly.
About the truth.
She does. I can see that clearly. She does have an agenda. Well, just like we do, but the truth is something that, I mean, you want to get as close to it as possible without having your own preconceived ideas, you know?
I'm looking at Strong's number 5221, the Hebrew word naka, and that means to strike. Right. And I want to naka her right in the head. That's the English word knock. I don't care how you look at it.
Well, you see, if a Jewess has a daughter, she's a daughter of a bitch because they're Canaanites. And if she has a son, he's a son of a bitch. And so when a person uses, they're not cursing when they speak of son of a bitch, they're talking of a son of a Canaanite.
Well, right. I'll assert that whore and bitch are Bible words, so I could use them. They're in the Bible.
Well, even the veterinarians and the dog breeders word bitch all the time. Nothing the matter with it. A bitch is a bitch, and a Canaanite is a Canaanite.
Well, John, I had a Hebrew scholar when I first started going on to TalkShoe, and I had first put my website up and got this English to Hebrew section on it back last summer, And I had a guy, his first name was Henry, and he uses his full name on TalkShoe, and I can't remember his last name. And it's that last name kind of looked Jewish, and maybe it's not, but, you know, he started dogging me on the Hebrew Englishes from Hebrew List, and I explained to him that very point, that with 500 cognates, or with 1,000 cognates, if I'm wrong about half of them, the other half stick, and 500 English words come from Hebrew, so we have to look at the origin of English. And he disappeared from my life right there. He never came back. He knew I was right. He knew he had nothing to say to me.
Well, how can you? I mean, when a word appears in a distant, faraway tongue that is not even in use anymore, or at least, you know, I don't count today's Hebrew as being Hebrew, but and it means the same thing. You have the same prefix or suffix, and it's just changed to match a different sort of tongue. I mean, how can you deny that? And it's the same meaning, as well as the same phonetics to it.
Well, right. It's the same phonetics and it's the same meaning, or it's a similar meaning, or the underlying concept is found in the meaning. That's all you need to make a cognate. I'm no grammarian as far as having a degree, but it's not rocket science.
No, it's not, and that's what people should realize. You don't need a so-called scholar to tell you this.
Well, a scholar would never tell me this. He'd be afraid he'd lose his damn job. He'd never get his next book funded, and he'd be out on the street where he belongs because he's nothing but a whore.
I hear that one. It's funny. This seems just like everything else, easier than it's made to appear.
Scholarship, yeah, you know, I say it all the time. Good scholarship is only being a good clerk, period. It's seeing something in one book and understanding how it affects something in another book. That's a clerical job. All you have to have is a decent memory.
So have we been intentionally removed from this language as a means of further control?
Well, Yahweh said that we were going to forget who we were because we were disobedient. We went and committed fornication. We broke his covenant. And he said that we were going to forget who we were. It's a matter of prophecy. And it happened. The Jews have never forgotten who they are or who they claim to be. There's no doubt. That's why I'm an identity adherent, because I see history. I read the Bible. I know the Bible's true. Once you apply the Bible to the correct parties, once you identify the correct parties involved and who they are, and that's why we call it identity. And the Bible's true. When you try to take the Israelites and everything that's said about them in the Bible and apply it to the Jews, the Bible falls apart. It's a book of bullshit. It's trash. And it just doesn't work. There's no way it can work because the Jews didn't do any of that stuff. And none of that stuff applies to the Jews. Well, when you study history and archaeology and make the realization that the Jews aren't those people, we are, and then read the Bible, the whole thing's perfect. The Word of God prevails. Okay, we got to have something else here tonight. We can't be done yet, can we?
I could talk for hours about these idiots spamming my email, but I won't go there.
Yeah, well, you saw it. Did you see what I put on the front page of Christogenia?
Yeah, I signed up to a whole bunch of very questionable sites with those emails already today.
It's a shame we have to waste our time like this, right? All these people have to do is stop hounding us to death. They want us to see that next message so they can show how smart they are, right? They're a bunch of damn morons. Russell Walker, J. Allen Croft. They're idiots, and they bicker back and forth endlessly. And yeah, they're time thieves. And I've been deleting their emails for months. I had thought before maybe I should post their emails somewhere conspicuous just to get even with them. And when you mentioned it the other day, I said, you know, that's a good idea. I'm going to slap their emails right on the front page of my site. So on the left-hand side of Christogenia, on the left-hand side of the Mein Kampf site, and pretty soon on the left-hand side at the bottom of the menu, on my 25 other websites, because I got at least 27 websites, I lost contract. I lost count a long time ago, but it's at least 27, and you will see a section called Spammers. Spammers, feel free to collect and spam the following email addresses. We are tired of them spamming us. The top one is Russell Walker. The next one is J. Allen Croft. They were warned they wouldn't take me off their circulation for all their bullshit, so now their email addresses are on the front page of one of the top 100,000 sites in the world. You think some spammers will see that?
That's good.
And it's staying there until they promise never to email me again. But, well, I didn't get an email from Marty since I warned them. But if I do, he's going on there, too.
I don't normally waste my time emailing, but I'll have to make a special exception.
But we'll just sign them up for all kinds of crazy dumb stuff like Mike did, right?
Well, if they weren't already, they are now members of NAMBLA, so.
That's perfect. Perfect. Members of NAMBLA. Well, you know, they probably, perhaps they should be. You'll excite Marty like that.
Yeah. You know, I gave the people on that list the benefit of a doubt to actually be able to contact me through email if they did have something worthwhile to say. But, after that whole crap today, I went through and I manually created a filter in my email account for each and every one of them I saw on there that was spamming. And then, I'm sure, John, you remember over the last few years of the No Planer crowd out there. They would hit our emails like crazy, just like that.
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. These people. I did a show. I just appeared as a guest with Wendy and on, White Think Tank on Talk Show. And this No Planer, I tell you, some of our people, this guy's a plant, or he's so dumb as to not realize that Judy Wood is a fraud. She's obviously a Jew, you just tell by her picture. But I didn't mention that.
Well, if it's open, you can tell me more about Hitler. I didn't make it to that Mein Kampf page yet, but because I wanted to get a little bit more of the foundation and history before I went off on that. But it seems like you could keep talking.
Well, Dan, you know, my cousin is... He's still stuck in the thing that Hitler somehow escaped the final destruction of Berlin, you know, or the capture of Berlin, and which was a destruction, by the way, and that these people like Hitler had body doubles, and that they even took pictures of these body doubles, and that they used them simply to deceive people so they would protect, let's say, the leader of a country. And that Hitler escaped to South America, I just don't buy it. He was a man of his word. You can say what you want about him, but he was a man of his word, and he did what he did. He said he would do, commit suicide, and that's it. He spared Germany any further humiliation.
That's what happened? He took himself out because he was causing problems?
Well,
causing problems, but maybe he wasn't able to stop or fulfill his agenda or stop what he saw was creating the problems?
He did fulfill his agenda, but the Jews rallied the whole world to come down on Germany because he fulfilled his agenda.
I mean, Dan, do you know how the war actually started?
One or two?
Two.
Not exactly, no.
Well, there were... Germany was mistreated at the Treaty of Versailles after World War I. And Hitler, when he came to power, wanted to solve these problems that were created by the Jews who ran forced this treaty upon the Germans. And they forced them to pay a lot of reparations. They destroyed their economy so they can take it over. They can just go in there and just buy up all the land and property as much as they could. And the average German was ruined in the early 1920s. Now, I mean, they had these pictures of these Germans actually carrying wheelbarrows full of money to buy a loaf of bread. That's how bad it got.
I heard and saw some stuff about that.
Right, and you think, and when the Germans found out it was the Jews who did all of that to them, don't you think they'd be a little pissed off? Of course they will. Of course they will.
Absolutely.
Right. So, now, even in spite of all that, did the Jews really hurt, or did the Germans actually hurt any of the Jews? Even during, all throughout the 1920s, the 1930s, really? What did they do? All they did was throw the communist Jews, most of them were Jews, you got to face the truth, they were Jews, and they were agitators. They threw them into these concentration camps, and they were taken care of. They were fed. They may not be, it wasn't a five-star hotel, I'll tell you that much, but it wasn't what they were claiming it was.
I understand that most of that was a lie.
But well, Auschwitz was a resort compared to the federal prison I was in. I mean, they had a club, they had prostitution, they had money, special money printed just for Auschwitz and the other concentration camps that they issued to the prisoners so they could buy things. They had a pool, they had a theater. It looks sweet. I wish Elkton was like that. I may not have got any work done.
Right. They also had a sports field. They played soccer all the time. They had a band. I mean, they weren't mistreated by a long shot from what they were describing. And it was only at the end of the war when the Germans, in many of the concentration camps, the Germans could barely support themselves. I mean, when you'd have your entire country's infrastructure bombed to hell by Allied bombers, and you had to allocate all as much as possible to the defense of the homeland, then yeah, you're going to run out of food in some places, because not all these concentration camps were ever all the prisoners starving. Some of them were, some of them weren't. It was in the worst, and they only focus on the worst places because that's their agenda, is to make it look like the Germans mistreated them when it was not intentional. Now,
I understand. Let me just say, I understand that things aren't as they seem. I from my understanding, I think that the other nations suffered more. They had far more casualties than any Jews. So I understand the deceit and the lie there. I just didn't fully understand Hitler's maybe position and his accomplishments.
Well, his position was Germany for Germans. Basically, what's wrong with that?
And during the Depression,
I don't see anything wrong with it. I just didn't fully understand it. I had heard a lot of talk about where he got his backing from. You know, was he really an agent for the bankers? You know, so I heard a lot of talk. What because Palestine, I believe, came out of that movement. You know, so I mean, it seemed to me that the overall outcome was just that the people in power only got a further and firmer grasp on it. You know, while a lot of our people suffered.
During the 1930s, Adolf Hitler, making his own money in the German economy, having an economy separate from the Jewish central banking economy, Germany thrived. Germany boomed. And the rest of the world was in a state of oppression and depression and starvation and poverty. Because they were under the Jewish central banking system, and their economies were being manipulated by the Jew so that the Jew could buy up all of American and European industry. And Hitler didn't want a thing to do with it.
No, that's the same thing that happened here. We were at one time printing our own, I think it was called colonial script, if I'm not mistaken.
But the usury-based economy is evil, and Hitler knew it. I went into that last night. I proved it right from the pages of Mein Kampf.
Yeah. Well, Dan, leading up to the war, now, after the Treaty of Versailles, there was a lot of land was taken away from the Germans. And there was a lot of, according to, and this was the hypocritical nature of the Jews that ran the Treaty of Versailles, and they forced it upon the Germans, that they wanted they claimed to want that ethnic groups would become part of the nation that they were, that their ethnic nationality was, and the Germans were denied that in the Sudetenland, in parts of Czechia should I say Bohemia, the Poland, all that land was just stripped away from the Germans. All of that Eastern Prussia, it was stripped away, and these people were Germans, and they were oppressed not only by every one of these other ethnicities, the Czechs, the Poles, but Hitler stood by for years and years and tolerated it while trying to work for a peaceful solution to regain those lands and those people who wanted to be back with their own country. And the Poles, just like we Americans today, were deceived because they had a massive amount of Jews in their country running the show, deceiving them, thinking that they could win a war against the Germans. I'm not saying that they couldn't have, but the Germans were definitely much better prepared and ready for it.
What was their interest in fighting the Germans? Why did they want to?
Because they wanted to, actually, Poland was convinced by their, and this is, you know, this is just something that I'm actually, it's not so much speculation, but it's from what, there's a lot of stuff about it we haven't been told, that there were border clashes between the Poles and the Germans, and they were being forced upon the Germans by the Jews deceiving the Poles into attacking them. And now probably a lot of these people were Jewish agents in Polish uniforms. I'm sure that was, you know, just like the CIA today. Who's really running that show? Who's working with the Mossad? It's the CIA. And who's running the FBI? Jews. So the Poles had their own organizations, and they were probably being run by the Jews too. And they were instigating the Germans with border clashes. And oppressing the German people, such as I think there was a massacre of like 5,000 Germans at one period in April of 1939, just like several months before the war. And it was like in one town. Just annihilated, slaughtered by these German these Polish Jews. I wouldn't even call them Poles. I would just call them Jews in Poland. Now, when things like atrocities like that are happening, there's only so much you can take before you must make a response. And Hitler, 3 days, according to his last testament, and this is confirmed, I believe, by Archibald Moll Ramsay, the Captain Ramsay, and the British Minister of Parliament, just before the war, and he was arrested for 4.5 years and thrown into prison without charge for telling the truth by the Churchill regime. And he explains it in his book, The Nameless War, which I posted a link on there. You can find it. But now that Hitler, 3 days before the German-Polish War, he offered a solution to the British ambassador in Berlin that, we would accept international control of the Polish corridor region that was taken away from Germany at the end of World War I. The French were ready to accede to those, that request, those demands. And the British did not, and they declared war when Germany finally said, enough is enough. We're not going to take this anymore. We're going to go in there and we're gonna take our land back. And the Poles also not only wanted to take all the German land in eastern Prussia away, they wanted to go right where it ended up at the end of World War II to the Oder. So they had a lot to gain. The Poles had a lot to gain by that because they were, again, I believe it's because they were deceived by the Jews.
The Jews were actually using the Soviets and I believe the House of Rothschild was actually using Poland to instigate the war. And as soon as Germany invaded Poland from the west, the Soviets invaded it from the east. But we and the Soviets didn't invade Poland what was any objective in mind, but to deprive Germany of taking all of it. And basically, they wanted it for themselves as much as Germany wanted it to stop the persecution of Germans. And the Soviets confiscated half of Poland, yet we never blamed the Soviets for starting the war by invading Poland. We sided with them, which is a blatant sign of our hypocrisy.
This is right. This is amazing. I never heard any of this before. So, Poland, all right, was going against Germany, instigated or driven by the Jews, and in that weakened state, still under control or under manipulation by the Jews, the Soviet Union, which was also at the time controlled by them,
came in.
Bolshevism was entirely Jewish.
Yeah, Dan, understand that this conspiracy goes so deep and into so many areas of our civilization, of any white nation, that it'll just blow your mind. It became as an epiphany to me. One of the two epiphanies I had was that the Protocols of Zion was a true document, and the second one was that the entire 20th century was manipulated by these people. And not only the entire 20th century, but I go back even further, the French Revolution, the Spanish Revolution in the 1930s, the English Revolution in the 1600s with King Charles. By the way, he's one of the only kings that they actually executed because they knew they had to get rid of this guy.
I understood and fully believed that they were pulling strings and manipulating, but I just had no idea to the depth. When I was on here the other night, is this Bill or John? I think, is that your name, Bill?
Yeah, that's me.
All right. So, you blew my mind when you were telling me about the Trojan War and how we've really just been fighting each other. Somebody's been pulling our strings so that we fight each other as far back as history's been recorded. It's just the same game being played over and over again.
Yeah, to a great degree. Let me read something, right? I want to read something, right? It goes back to what you were saying before about the so-called Holocaust, right? But this is this is from a very recent Washington Post article on fags in the military, right? And they're talking about, how the Army, guys in the Army, what do they know? And in 1947, they didn't want niggers in the military, right? And this is two short paragraphs, one to show the context and the other one to show my point. And they're both in the article. This is a quote from the article. In a study from July 1947, four or five enlisted men told the Army that they would oppose blacks serving in their units, even if whites and blacks did not share housing or food facilities. The same study also revealed, now this is 1947, right? The same study also revealed a deep resentment towards Jews. Most enlisted men said Jews had profited greatly from the war, and many doubted that the Jews had suffered under Adolf Hitler. The Washington Post, the Jews always tell on themselves somewhere, right? And this is one of those places. 1947, most enlisted men who had been just returned from Europe outed that the Jews suffered under Hitler.
That's nice. I know they always put it out there. You just got to catch it.
Well, yeah, these soldiers that returned, when Eisenhower, the Jew, put the former German soldiers, the ones captured at the end of the war, inside these massive, they just stuffed them into, open air prison camps. And I wouldn't even call them a prison camp. It was just an open field with a big fence put around it and guns surrounded by guns, and they starved these people to death.
I remember reading about that, yeah.
I think it was somewhere around 1.5 million. I mean, they just didn't feed them. They left them exposed. And that was it.
I have that information on a Mein Kampf site somewhere from articles that are extant elsewhere on the internet.
That goes back to what I was saying, how it was our people, that suffered largely in those camps that were, just left out there to starve and die. It wasn't really Jews in Auschwitz or whatever.
Well, when you have total war waged against your country by, the most massive powers in all the in the world, what's going to happen in the middle of your country to prisoners in any camp? You're lucky if you allocate any sort of resources to them. They would feel privileged. Or they should feel privileged. When all your effort has to be geared into defending your country against an invasion. This was a literal invasion of a white country by another white country and a complete takeover and destruction of it. So if you got out of any of those prison camps still, fairly nourished, then you should, I think you should feel very lucky.
I imagine any of them do.
Well, I have pictures that were right in the New York Times. I'd like to get them online someday, but they're in my, they're in a pile of four crates of papers that I have to go through. and it's impossible. There were a bunch of pictures that were published in the New York Times of Jews being released from Auschwitz, and it was mostly women and children, male and female children, and it was that they were a bunch of fat, happy women and children, and they didn't look hungry one bit. They looked like filthy Jews, but they didn't look hungry.
Well, let me add to that. The Germans, when they abandoned these camps in Eastern Europe and Poland, when they were retreating against the Soviet armies, they gave the people in there a choice. They can either stay with the Soviets, wait for them to come and so-called liberate them, or they can come with the Germans. And most of them, if not all of them, that could walk, went with the Germans.
But, well, the Jews have tried to fashion history in a way that supports, first covers for all of their crimes, and second, supports the Jewish imposed tyranny over all of the Western white nations. And all of history is molded to produce that effect on behalf of the Jews, to keep them in their position of power.
Oh, I see that clearly. I see it any time it's the propaganda's thick. Any time you watch any kind of television at all, it's in every show. And that's why they own all the printing presses and movies, the houses, everything. I see it. I just had no idea the depth how they continue to just manipulate our basically brothers against brothers over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. It amazed me. I didn't know it went back as far as it does to basically the beginning.
Well, it does. I mean, let me tell you, the Jews took over the Catholic Church in the 15th century, and the Medici popes legitimized English, legitimized usury, and they were Jews. Three Medici popes were Jews. And the result of that was not only the Reformation, but then the 30 Years' War, where, again, white man was killing white man on behalf of those Jewish popes. It goes back, and when you study one event, you got to go back to the one before that, and back to the one before that, and it goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden.
So you were saying earlier, Hitler he committed suicide because to stop further harm to his people.
Well, John probably knows more than that than I do, but I believe that Hitler wasn't planning on being taken alive, right? I believe that he killed himself. I don't believe that he escaped to Argentina or that Elvis was seen in 7-Elevens in Memphis in the 70s or anything like that.
So he really didn't fly off on that UFO?
Right.
Yeah. Hitler, he committed suicide because he knew what would happen if he were captured alive, or even if his body was found. Because then they would use it as a trophy, they would put it on television, they would use it in every sort of way to humiliate Germany to the nth degree, even further. So he knew that his body had to disappear. And that's what he gave the order to his personal bodyguard 10 minutes after he heard the two gunshots, come in there, burn the bodies, make sure nothing remains. And he deprived the Jews of further humiliation of Germany, and they I'm sure that eats them up to this day.
Hey, Dan, I got a movie I can pass on to you that gives a fair depiction of what happened at the end there, called Downfall. Now, it's got some edges in the movie that you obviously got to pay attention to, but otherwise, you know, it shows why Goebbels and Hitler took themselves out, which is basically what John was just saying, but it did a pretty good articulation of that.
No, I had no idea even about that. I mean, I can completely understand what you're saying and why I wouldn't want to give him that satisfaction either.
Here, Dan, up in the chat, I posted Hitler's last testament. I'm sure it's true. If you scroll, here, let me post it again. I mean, that should give you his thoughts on it. Of course, you know, Jews will, anyone else would say, oh, that's all a lie. But it's not a lie. Because I can confirm his statements through Captain Ramsey.
I have that Captain Ramsey paper, The Nameless War, somewhere. I thought I already had it on the Saxon Messenger site. If I don't, I'll put it on there soon. It's been something that's been on my mind. I can't find it on the Saxon Messenger site, so I must have I must not have it there yet. Unless it's in PDF format, and that's a possibility. If it's in PDF format, my site search don't work on it.
Hey, John, do you remember a while back we were trying to look into this supposed, you know, if you were to ask Alex Jones, they were calling it the fascist coup. But this was back in the early 30s, and it seemed to coincide with the rise of Hitler. And I was just wondering if anybody else had ever picked up on that, because there's not a lot of written about that. But this is where Smedley Butler was supposed to be in charge of over 500,000 troops to overthrow the government at that time, which, I mean, looking back at history, couldn't have been any worse than what we have now. Maybe it was actually a pro, you know, National Socialist attempted overthrow that Smedley probably passed up on there.
You know, Mike, I've never heard of such a thing. I know Smedley Butler, I know his book about war is a racket, but I don't think he was privy to the Jew, from what I gather in his book.
Yeah, obviously not. But
no, I don't. Yeah, like a 7 days in May scenario, I just don't see it happening. It's definitely not going to happen now.
No, this was supposed to happen back in the early 30s, right at the same time that Hitler was getting into power. And it was supposed, you know, like I said, I saw some of this on some other websites, and I forget where I saw it, on Wikipedia and such, but like I said, there's not a lot written about it, because it probably would be inspiring to look at that there actually was a decent attempt with military leaders back then to overthrow, but it was, you know, according to the Alex Jones official story, it was an attempted fascist overthrow of the United States, in which they were going to use Smedley Butler to overthrow the current Jew government that was going on. Now, mind you, this is, like I said, this is right at the time that Hitler was coming to power over in Germany, and Smedley Butler basically backed out, and that's where he spawned the war as a racket here. I'm going to find a link to something that relates to this and see if you guys have seen this, or maybe we can look into it. Okay, yeah, here, I found it. I found something on it here.
Shut my mic off to cough, and it came off John's mic.
There goes a link in the chat there if you guys want to, maybe if anybody remembers that or knows anything about it, but I think it would be an extremely interesting story to trace back and look at what potentially could have turned this country around, you know, only less than 20 years after the Federal Reserve takeover.
Well, it just wasn't meant to be.
No, it wasn't. It's just a piece of history to learn about at this point, but...
Well, Mike, look what it says here. Wall Street's plot to seize the White House.
Well, you got to look at it through the eyes of the Alex Jonesies out here. I mean, this is, oh my God, the white man, the Anglo-Saxon banker was in the fascist. And so, you know, looking at it from there, you get a better understanding.
Well, Wall Street did seize the White House in 1912 when Woodrow Wilson got there.
Right, the whole just the title of this proves that it's a fraud.
Well,
or.
Well, it certainly something did happen, because, like I said, Smedley Butler wrote the book War is a Racket because of this whole incident where he was supposedly being coerced to lead 500,000 troops to do this takeover.
Yeah, well, there might be something to it from the viewpoint of somebody that knows that doesn't have the level of awareness that we have, right?
Exactly.
But I think the Jews were instrumental in getting Teddy Roosevelt to run so that Taft would lose, so that Wilson could walk into the White House. They were triangulating presidential elections back then. It's third-party candidates that would pull just enough of the vote to let their man win.
I just read that. So basically, he didn't really make any offensive moves. He was on the defense, and he took himself out of power to stop his people from suffering any further.
Well, you know, the German invasion, the German invasion of Russia. Russia was about to invade Germany. That's why Hitler invaded Russia, because he had no choice.
Well, that's what I meant by defensive. He was, his back was against the wall, and if he didn't proactively act, he was going to have to face it anyways.
But right. He had to invade Holland to guard the Rhine, so that a sea route couldn't be made right into the industrial heartland of Germany. the Tsar land. He had to invade Russia to stop Russia from the Soviets from flattening all of Europe. Stalin was about to overrun all of Europe. He wasn't going to stop at Germany either. He wasn't going to stop at Ireland if he didn't have to.
Well, let me add to that, Dan. I don't doubt what Bill said about Holland and everything, but the only reason why the Germans invaded the West, let's say, for instance, Norway, let's start with Norway. Why did they do that? Hitler was of two minds, according to, if you go to the, I think, the U.S. Military History Museum site, you will find that their analysis was Hitler was of two minds of invading Norway because he knew that the British and the French were going to invade there to deny the iron ore shipments coming from that region. So he was of two minds whether to do it or not. In the end, he decided to do it in order to prevent the British and French from surrounding Germany and from denying them their iron ore shipments. The same, and Denmark was invaded because that was a natural route. I mean, you had to go through Denmark in order to get to Norway, pretty much. So there was no way. And actually, the Danes were allowed to keep their own government and their own administration. And that's what they don't tell you about. And there was only like one gunshot fired in Denmark. And that was just a formal act of resistance, let's put it, by the Danes to say, yeah, we oppose this, but we're willing to cooperate. Now, and the Norwegians also, many of them also cooperated too. Now, why did the Germans invade France, the Low Countries of Belgium, Luxembourg, Netherlands? They did it because the British government was then taken over by the Churchill regime on May 10th. May 10th was a key date that not only was that was the start of the German invasion of the West, but it was the date where Churchill took over from Neville Chamberlain, because Chamberlain was ousted in favor of this Jew puppet, Churchill. And Churchill's plan was to do what the Jews wanted him to and bomb German cities and German civilians. Hitler said, no, we're not going to take that, and he invaded.
Well, he waited 7 weeks, too, of German cities being bombed before he reciprocated, right?
That's correct. In the summer, when the British were bombing them, he didn't respond for two and a half months. And then, finally, they threw up their hands and said, okay, you want it? We're going to give it to you. And they did, and the Battle of Britain started. Now, again, they don't tell you this in your history class, do they?
No, none of that.
Nope, Hitler did not want to bomb British population areas. But after, I thought it was 7 weeks, it could have been 10 weeks. He had no choice. He felt he had no choice. He had to reciprocate.
Yeah, actually, yeah, you might be right. It could have been 6 or 7 weeks. I'm not sure exactly.
Well, it don't matter. It was a long period of time of getting German cities bombed and not responding when you have all the capacity to respond.
Right. And instead of bombing, attempting to bomb, and they couldn't bomb British cities, which they didn't want to do anyway, from Germany at that period to fly over neutral territory. They would have to fly over Belgium and Holland. And, of course, the Dutch and the Belgians, they're not going to allow that. And the British, you know, they would just fly their bombers over the North Sea because they had long-range bombers. The Germans did not. They had medium-range bombers. They didn't have any four-engine bombers. The British did. Now, the only way the Germans could respond was through a land campaign, and they did that.
I'm still here. This is just a lot of great stuff. I've never heard it before, so it's processing.
Yeah, I mean, and just the fact alone, militarily, the Germans didn't have any long-range bombers, so they weren't bent on an aggressive attitude.
They would have been building them in 1935 or 36, which they weren't doing, because they never wanted to invade Britain.
Then you have Yugoslavia, which is another story altogether, which was another coup, pulled off down there by the British, by the British intelligence. I put British in quotes. It's actually, you know, Jews using the British in order to gain an ally on Germany's back door. and probably use the air bases there to bomb Germany. And, of course, can't allow that, so you got to invade another country. Now, one of the dark spots of the World War II for the Axis was Italy. Italy was a liability from the start. Mussolini, with the big head he had, he invaded Greece. And for no reason. There was no reason for him to go in there. And yet he did it. And he got his ass kicked. Excuse my language, but that's basically what happened. And until the Germans came and bailed him out. And the same thing in North Africa. They had a huge army. 200,000 men against 30,000 British. And that 30,000 British beat them up in North Africa. And again, the German Africa Corps had to go down there and save his butt, too. So Italy was just a huge liability during the war. They should have remained neutral.
Well, just before, I don't know if we're going to wrap it up, right? If nobody talks, we're going to wrap it up soon, though. But just before I wrap it up, I mean, most of you people know there's a chat room now on Christogenia.org. It's not meant to replace this by any means, but it's meant to give people a place maybe to trap people to get them to come here or to get them interested in coming here just a place for people to hang out while they listen to the Christogenia Internet radio station that's been put up this week. As we have our own streaming radio station publicly listed on the Shoutcast radio directory. And I hope to expand that soon into four channels, two channels each on two different stations on each of my servers. So the second station would actually share a server with this TeamSpeak, but it won't affect TeamSpeak in any way. The server address for the internet radio is only for your Winamp player or your VLC media player or your Windows media player. And it's christogenia.org/8000/live, L-I-V-E. And right now I only have it hooked up to cycle through 95 Christogenos broadcasts, Christogenos programs that Eli and I have done together on the 2C line program on Friday nights. And the other channels I'm looking to set up this month are going to be done similarly. I just thought I'd mention that, plug that before. And you could listen here. I stream it into here when I'm not doing a program, and into that Christogenia streaming audio channel. So if you come here and nobody's here and you want to listen to something, you could listen to that here, or you could go to christogenia.org/chat. And there's a chat page, and the link to it's actually right on the main menu at the top. And there's a chat room there and a radio player so that you could click on the radio player and listen to the chat room there, right? Well, listen to the and talk in the chat room there. And it works pretty good. And I even put a copy of that globe on that page so that you could probably see who you're chatting with, or at least where they're at, right? Well, right, Eighth Day Woman, and this internet streaming radio can actually be picked up with things like iPods and stuff like that, too, so.
Oh, I just picked up on a little something here.
What's that, Mike?
Well, apparently the committee that took down this fascist coup with Smedley Butler, one of them was named Samuel Dickstein, who was a Democratic congressional representative from New York, paid agent of the NKVD, and a New York State Supreme Justice. He played a key role in establishing the committee that would become the House Committee on Un-American Activities, which he used to attack fascists, including Nazi sympathizers and supposedly suspected communists. And he was from a Jewish family in Lithuania who was brought here in 1887 with his parents and settled in New York City. And he was the second head of the committee. It goes on later to say in his bio here that he vehemently fought anti-Semitism and such. And yeah, there you go.
Yeah, well, I can't think of a better name for a Jew than Dickstein.
I'm going to have to look at more into this story, because the more I'm picking pieces of it, it's looking a lot more interesting here.
I wonder if his mother's last name was Samuelson, because he's Samuel.
Yeah,
okay, I'm going to, I don't know, we can move down to the open house or something, but I'm going to call it a night. Unless, yeah, you know, it's midnight, let's call it a night, and we could go to the open house and talk for 4 more hours, but I'm going to end the program. And thanks, everybody, for coming, and praise Yahweh.